Welcome to Ben Franklin's World, a podcast about early American history with Liz Covart. The study of history is key to understanding who we are and how we can affect a better future. Ben Franklin's World will introduce you to historical people and events that have impacted and shaped our present-day world. And now, here's your host, Liz Covart.
Hello, and welcome to episode 38 of Ben Franklin's World, the podcast dedicated to helping you learn more about how the people and events of our early American past have shaped the present-day world we live in. Today's episode is dropping on July 14th, Bastille Day. On this day in 1789, citizens of France rose up and stormed the Bastille, a French prison, and that event marked the beginning of the French Revolution. So Bastille Day is to France what the 4th of July is to the United States. So for those who celebrate Bastille Day, happy Bastille Day! And I would have given you my sentiments in French, but I have a really horrible French accent, so I think it's just better that we express them in English. Leave it at that. Although I bring up the French Revolution, today's episode is actually about another historical event, the 800th anniversary of Magna Carta. So in this episode, we're going to chat with Carolyn Harris, an historian of European monarchy and the author of Magna Carta and Its Gifts to Canada, Democracy, Law, and Human Rights. Carolyn is an expert on Magna Carta and on the history of royal families in England and elsewhere in Europe. So needless to say, we're about to have a pretty broad-ranging conversation about Magna Carta. During our conversation, Carolyn reveals what Magna Carta is and why it was created in 2015, the four key principles contained in the Great Charter, and how Magna Carta influenced the American Revolution, the development of constitutional monarchy in Canada, and whether the ideas of Magna Carta are still relevant in our 21st century. Now, I hope you're ready for some time travel, because this episode is about to cover 800 years of history. But before we go back in time, I have a little acknowledgement to make. I had a technical snafu in this episode, which means Carolyn's copy came out fine, but every question I asked was backgrounded with static. It was too staticky to air, so I went through and I copied all of my comments verbatim and re-recorded them. So if something sounds a little bit red, that's because it is red. I tried to really get the essence of what I said to Carolyn perfect so that her responses would line up. So that's on me. I apologize for that. I'm going to be extra careful as I record in the future. Okay, with that acknowledgement out of the way, let's get to it. Let's go back 800 years of history.
With tidings and wisdom to share about our early American past, here is this week's special guest.
Today's guest is an historian of European monarchy based in Toronto, Canada, where she teaches at the University of Toronto School of Continuing Studies. She is a regular commentator on royal history and the British royal family for Canadian television and radio outlets. She is also the author of numerous articles, book chapters, and a book, Magna Carta and Its Gifts to Canada, Democracy, Law, and Human Rights. Carolyn Harris, welcome to Ben Franklin's World.
Great to be here.
Carolyn, we are excited to have you join us today so we can learn more about Magna Carta, which is celebrating its 800th birthday this year in 2015. Would you tell us what Magna Carta is and why English-speaking nations around the world are celebrating the 800th anniversary of its creation?
Well, Magna Carta is a charter of liberties that was imposed on King John of England by his barons on June 15th, 1215. And it's the first example of an English monarch accepting limits on his power imposed by his subjects. And within the document, there are numerous clauses that are specific to the conditions of 1215, release of Welsh and Scottish hostages, for example. But there are also embedded in this document clauses that have stood the test of time, the foundation of the English common law system in use throughout the English-speaking world, of there being a degree of due process and freedom from arbitrary rule, that's embedded in Magna Carta, and the idea of there being, you know, checks and balances on the state.
Is this the same King John of Robin Hood fame?
Yes, this is the same King John of Robin Hood fame. In the Robin Hood legends, he's Prince John scheming away home in England while his elder brother, King Richard, was on crusade. And then King Richard was taken captive on his way home from crusade. And so this provided an opportunity for John to attempt to expand his power. Historically, Prince John teamed up with King Philip II of France in order to invade his brother's lands. The Robin Hood legends in the past have been set in numerous different reigns, but by the 19th century, the Robin Hood legends were quite firmly set in King Richard's reign with this crusading heroic elder brother and the younger brother who's rather a sniveling villain. And this image has been reinforced by numerous Robin Hood films over the course of the 20th and now the 21st century, that we see John being portrayed in popular culture as not just a villain, but a sniveling villain, who's quite cowardly and easily overwhelmed when his brother finally returns from crusade. So for many people, this is the image they have of John as prince and king, is the villain of the Robin Hood legends.
Is that an accurate image of King John, or has it been embellished over the last 800 years?
Well, it's accurate in the sense of getting the sense of how John was very unpopular in his own time. These are the conditions that lead to Magna Carta. So the fact that he's portrayed unfavorably in popular culture depicts the fact that he was seen unfavorably in his own time. But the portrayal of him as a rather sniveling villain is not necessarily historical, as in 1215 he was viewed as a really great threat to the prerogatives of the English barons and to English laws and customs. So he was seen as a very real threat to the law of the land, not as this rather comic sniveling figure that he's gone down in history as.
From your description, King John does seem like a monarch that needed to have his powers checked. And I wonder if you would tell us who decided to check his powers. Who wrote Magna Carta? And why did they feel like England in general needed a great charter in 1215? Was it just because of King John, or were there previous kings or future kings that they worried about?
Well, certainly for King John's barons, there was a sense, not that they were revolutionaries who were insisting that King John apply himself to new laws. They saw themselves as very conservative in a sense, that they were holding King John to the established customs and laws of the land. Previous monarchs, since the Norman conquest of 1066, had issued coronation charters that had stated what they would do during their reign, that they would uphold the rights of the church, the rights of the barons. If we look at the coronation charter of King Henry I, for instance, that dates from the year 1100, we see a structure very similar to Magna Carta. It begins with freedom for the church, inheritance rights for the barons. There's a reference to respecting the laws of the land. There's even the inheritance rights for noble widows and freedom from forced remarriage that we also see in Magna Carta. So there was this long tradition of previous monarchs having issued charters stating that they would respect the laws of the land and the rights of the church and the nobility. Various political circumstances had led to monarchs of violating these terms. King Richard's participation in the Third Crusade was extremely expensive, and so new taxes had been imposed in England, the Saladin tithe, as one of these taxes was known, and there were further taxes to pay King Richard's ransom once he was captured on his way home from crusade. This is where the phrase a king's ransom comes from. And then by John's reign, John managed to alienate very key groups among his subjects. First and foremost, the church. He was excommunicated by the Pope following a conflict over who would be the next Archbishop of Canterbury. The Pope favored Stephen Langton, who King John was against having in that post, as Langton was closely associated with the King of France and the French court. John and the King of France had been allies during Richard's reign, but were once again at odds once John became king. So John was very much against having Langton as Archbishop of Canterbury. Eventually, political circumstances would oblige him to accept Stephen Langton in this role. And Langton became one of the key authors of Magna Carta, bringing together the grievances of the various barons and merchants and clergy. The barons, of course, were a key group that John alienated as well. He needed almost constant funds for his wars against France. We have to remember at this time the King of England isn't merely the King of England, but Duke of Normandy, Count of Anjou, Duke of Aquitaine, all of these lands that are now part of northern and western France. This is the period in the early 13th century when the King of France is moving into these lands and conquering them from the King of England. So John required funding and military support for his various wars. And if he'd been able to deliver military victories, his powerful subjects might have accepted him despite all his other flaws. But the fact that he had a series of military defeats and lost much of this French land made him extremely unpopular. John also had a reputation for personal villainy that comes out in the chroniclers. We have to bear in mind a lot of the chronicles are kept by the monks at that time, and John was at odds with the church, so that influenced how he was perceived. But we see examples of previous kings had taken mistresses, but John seemed to favor the wives and daughters of his barons, which meant that some of his barons had very personal grievances against John, and not simply political grievances. So by 1215, John has alienated the church. He's alienated the key faction of rebel barons. He's alienated the city of London. The loss of the city of London was what led to John having to accept Magna Carta. He's also alienated his son-in-law, Llewellyn the Great, Prince of Wales, and his future son-in-law, King Alexander of Scotland. So John's perceived villainy brought together all these various groups who might normally have conflicts with each other, but they were united in their opposition to John.
In Magna Carta and its gifts to Canada, Carolyn reveals that the Great Charter outlined four key principles. Carolyn, you have touched upon these principles in passing, but would you address them more specifically? What are the principles contained in Magna Carta?
Well, as I mentioned before, we do have all sorts of principles that apply to the conditions of the 13th century. But when we look more specifically at the center of the document, clauses 39 and 40, we see key principles that have stood the test of time. One key principle is the idea that nobody is above the law of the land. There were established customs and laws that dated from Anglo-Saxon times, from before the Norman conquest of 1066. And while we think of the first Norman king, William I, as William the Conqueror, William saw himself as the legitimate successor to the Anglo-Saxon line. The second last Anglo-Saxon king, Edward the Confessor, had been a cousin of his. So William the Conqueror made clear that he was going to respect and uphold these Anglo-Saxon laws that had existed before 1066. And the coronation charters of subsequent kings also make clear that they're part of that legal tradition. Now, where John alienated this key faction of rebel barons, that he placed himself as being above these laws of the land, imposing arbitrary and harsh punishments for comparatively minor offenses, making changes to the customary inheritance rights of the nobility to ensure that he would receive a greater amount of the income that was being transferred from generation to generation. So John had placed himself in a role where he was above the law in many ways. And what's key about Magna Carta is it places the king within the legal framework. There are clear penalties in the document if the king decides to violate the law of the land, that he might be punished financially. And this continues over the course of the 13th century with the development of Parliament, the idea of there being all these outside checks and balances on the monarch's rule to ensure that the monarch obeys the law of the land. We also see the right to judgment by one's peers. This is another idea that had been alluded to within the earlier coronation charters. Because of the feudal system that existed at this time in England, the entire noble class was expected to have a working knowledge of the law, as they would be presiding over manorial courts and judging disputes among the peasantry that worked on their land. John's father, Henry II, had made efforts to centralize the justice system to some degree, ensure that there was a grand jury, but formal legal education and the laws of a very specific profession doesn't develop until a bit later in the 13th century. At this time, the whole noble class is expected to have a knowledge of the law of the land, and therefore the nobility strongly believed in settling disputes amongst themselves. Previous monarchs had acknowledged this, that cases of treason, for instance, would be judged by the king, but land disputes between various members of the nobility might be judged amongst themselves. So we see this early nod to the right to judgment by one's peers. We see another key principle is an early example of women's rights in Magna Carta. It's a very small example for a very small portion of the population, elite noble widows who were exempt from forced remarriage and were allowed to receive their inheritance upon becoming widowed. And this wasn't seen at the time as strictly an issue that affected women, but that affected the entire noble class. Both King Richard and King John, in order to fund their various wars, Richard in the case of the Crusade and John in the case of his wars on the continent, had sold the right to marry noble widows to their supporters, you know, those who provided either financial or military aid. And this was considered destabilizing for the noble class, as there was a lot of concern amongst the various barons that if one of them were to die in battle, his widow might be forced to remarry, and the second husband might squander the inheritance before the children of the first marriage were able to grow up and inherit. So we have this precedent being set that would later inform future legislation regarding women's rights and women's property. But at the time, it was very much seen as upholding the prerogatives of the noble class as a whole, making sure that inheritance passed smoothly from generation to generation. So we see all of these principles bringing together Magna Carta as a document that would uphold the legal rights of the nobility. There are also clauses applying to the clergy, Archbishop Stephen Langton being one of the authors of the document, a key author. The document, of course, begins with freedom for the church. We also see clauses regarding the rights of the merchants to come and go from England without let and hindrance, but it wouldn't be until later in the Middle Ages that we see the provisions in Magna Carta extending from free men to men of any condition they would be. It would take the breakdown of the feudal system before a lot of these privileges that applied to the barons would be extended to the population as a whole.
Magna Carta was a big deal. It seemed that most Englishmen in the 13th century had heard of the document and could tell you the rights, privileges, and limitations on the powers of the king that it contained. But by the 16th century, it became an obscure legal text that few had heard of. Carolyn, how and why did the Great Charter fall out of favor and away from the forefront of English minds between the 13th and the 16th centuries?
Well, it's interesting, over the course of the 13th century, Magna Carta was very well known. Because the document was copied by scribes, engrossed with the king's seal, and these various versions of the document were distributed throughout England and probably into Scotland and Wales as well, considering there was Scottish and Welsh participation in support for the document. So hundreds of copies of Magna Carta were created over the course of the 13th century, and the document was designed to be consulted in castles, in cathedrals, and in law courts. Throughout England, it was read aloud. We have to bear in mind that much of the population was not literate at this time. It was translated from the Latin into Norman French, the language of the nobility, and English, the language of the common people. And we see the document being reissued by John's son, Henry III, and his grandson, Edward I, And the document plays a key role in the political developments of the 13th century. The Second Barons' War breaks out during the reign of King Henry III, John's son. Now, Henry III did not share John's reputation for villainy. He's the king who commissioned the Westminster Abbey that we can see today, and was by all accounts a very devoted husband and father. So he had many personal virtues, but he was prone to favoritism and to favoring foreign relatives of his mother and his wife over his English barons. And so we see the development of parliamentary institutions to keep the king in check and ensure that there was that there was equality before the law. So this year isn't just the 800th anniversary of Magna Carta; it's also the 750th anniversary of the de Montfort Parliament, which served as a prototype for future parliaments. Edward I, John's grandson, also reissued Magna Carta. He was a more successful king in many ways than John and Henry III, in that he did have military victories. He absorbed Wales into England and invaded Scotland. For many people today, Edward I is best known as the villain in Mel Gibson's Braveheart, you know, in invading Scotland and depriving the Scots of their freedom. So Edward I is certainly not well thought of in Scotland or Wales, but within England, he was generally seen as quite a strong king, and also one who was willing to work with his subjects to reissue Magna Carta. So there are a number of surviving copies of Magna Carta today that date from Edward I's reign. In the 14th century, Magna Carta, if anything, expands in significance because the feudal system breaks down. In 1348, the Black Death plague comes to England, and that reduced the population by 30 to 50%. And as a result of that, the peasantry, many of whom had been serfs bound to the land of their noble lords, they become more mobile. There's a number of peasant revolts in the 14th century. And Edward III, Edward I's grandson, issued the six statutes stating that the provisions of Magna Carta would apply to people of all social backgrounds, not simply free men, as the old distinctions between in serfed peasantry and free men were breaking down at this time due to the tremendous social change that followed the plague. It was affirmed in the 15th century that the legal provisions in Magna Carta also applied to ladies as well. So over the course of the Middle Ages, it looked as though Magna Carta, if anything, was becoming more significant rather than less so. This changes in the late 15th century with the Wars of the Roses, the conflicts between Edward III's descendants, the House of Lancaster and the House of York, and then the rise of the Tudor dynasty following Henry VII's defeat of Richard III at the Battle of Bosworth Field in 1485, that during both the Wars of the Roses and the Tudor period, there's the sense that a strong monarch was needed in order to ensure stability for England and England's independence against foreign incursions. So the invention of the printing press, for instance, that should have led to Magna Carta being spread further than ever. Instead, we see the earliest versions of Magna Carta that are printed being printed in volumes of legal documents. Magna Carta had become a comparatively obscure legal text. It wasn't being reissued by the various monarchs in the Tudor period as it was in medieval times. By the time William Shakespeare is writing his play King John during the reign of Elizabeth I, the granddaughter of Henry VII and daughter of Henry VIII, we don't see a single reference to Magna Carta in this play, and that seems rather shocking. It's like writing a play about George Washington and leaving out the American Revolution. There's something key that's missing there. But in Shakespeare's time, Magna Carta was an obscure legal document, and it didn't have that popular significance. So if you watch a performance of Shakespeare's King John, you see the barons preparing to revolt, and then you see John's death in 1216 and the accession of his son Henry III. But that key moment in the modern consciousness, the John accepting those limits on his power in Runnymede Meadow in 1215, the Magna Carta. That's not there in Shakespeare's King John. It wouldn't be until the reign of Elizabeth I's successor, James I, that Magna Carta would enjoy a revival that continues to the present day.
The conditions in England required a strong monarch, so many in England let Magna Carta fall out of their minds because they didn't want the Great Charter to limit the powers of their king. But by the reign of King James I in the 16th century, Magna Carta saw a resurgence, and a lot of that resurgence seemed to be due to Sir Edward Cook and his work. Carolyn, I wonder if you would tell us who Sir Edward Cook was and how he helped revive knowledge of and adherence to the ideas of Magna Carta.
Well, first I should note that not all English people in the 16th century had forgotten about Magna Carta. There were attempts to revive the document before Sir Edward Cook's time. Thomas More, for instance, Henry VIII's chancellor, tried to argue the provisions regarding freedom of the church in order to resist the introduction of Protestantism in England during Henry VIII's reign and the establishment of the Church of England. Now, on the one hand, Henry VIII, you know, considered himself an intellectual and took an interest in the law and applied a semblance of legal proceedings to many of the things he did. But Henry VIII was also very determined to have his own way, particularly in the matter of religion. And so Thomas More was beheaded for treason. So the fact that those who attempted to defend Magna Carta in Tudor times often met an end similar to Thomas More's discouraged the charter from having its revival over the course of the 16th century. Now, Sir Edward Cook was a renowned jurist, and he had a very long career in the late 16th and early 17th centuries that spanned the reigns of Elizabeth I and her successors, James I and Charles I. So he was born at the right time in some ways when there was more openness to his ideas and to a revival of Magna Carta. James I, well, he had been James VI of Scotland before he became James I of England, was another monarch who considered himself an intellectual and had written a number of treatises on government. So rather than suppressing, you know, disagreement with his rule, James I was prepared to debate Sir Edward Cook. And Cook emphasized how important Magna Carta was to the foundation of English liberties. For Cook, Magna Carta wasn't simply another medieval charter, but was the foundation document of the rights and freedoms enjoyed by the English in his own time in the early 17th century. And Cook emphasized that key principle that not even the king was above the law of the land. Something else that Sir Edward Cook did as well was to expand the definition of arbitrary rule. Magna Carta's clauses had guaranteed a freedom from arbitrary rule, but Cook expanded that to address arbitrary taxation. And this particularly became significant during the reign of James I's son, Charles I, who was not as inclined to debate ideas as his father had been. Charles I saw himself as an absolutist monarch, similar to what was happening in France, and was determined to have his own way. So in many senses, the apogee of Sir Edward Cook's legal career was authoring the Petition of Right in 1628, which attempted to limit Charles I's powers and expanded that definition of arbitrary rule to include freedom from arbitrary taxation. Now, in a more global sense, Sir Edward Cook's ideas spread in that he was involved in authoring the founding charter of the state of Virginia, for example, so his ideas made it to the 13 colonies that way. And Cook also wrote the law textbooks, the institutes of laws at that time that were studied by Thomas Jefferson and James Madison. So when we think of the significance of Magna Carta today, often we're thinking of Magna Carta through the lens of Cook's commentaries, which in many ways came to be seen as more significant in a global context than the original document itself. So Cook had a very long and prominent legal career at the same time that the English-speaking world was expanding and Cook's ideas spread with this age of exploration.
Thank you for all of this background information on Magna Carta, why it was created, and how it was applied. Now let's jump forward a bit and look at its legacy. In 1763, King George III issued the Royal Proclamation of 1763. The proclamation sought to bring peace to North America by preventing colonial expansion west of the Appalachian Mountains. In the United States, we tend to view this proclamation as problematic. It was one of the causes of the American Revolution. However, when I read Carolyn's book, Magna Carta and Its Gifts to Canada, I learned that Canadians view the proclamation of 1763 more favorably and as the Indian Magna Carta. Carolyn, how did Magna Carta inspire the Royal Proclamation of 1763? And why do you think Canadians view the proclamation in a positive manner, and Americans tend to see it in a more problematic or negative light?
Well, it's interesting. We look at the Royal Proclamation of 1763. It's one of those key moments where American and Canadian history diverges and goes down very different paths. The proclamation came out of the Seven Years' War, and Britain had conquered much of French Canada and absorbed Quebec. And King George III wanted to be able to bring his troops home and not have to keep a constant military presence in order to defend these new acquisitions. So George III came to terms with his native allies through the Royal Proclamation of 1763, and also with French Canada, or what had been French Canada, through the Quebec Act of 1774. And it's interesting the way the Royal Proclamation in particular is viewed in Canada and the United States. For George III's native allies, the Royal Proclamation was a key example of the Crown serving as a protector of the First Nations and upholding their land rights. Land transfers were to go through the Crown. The Royal Proclamation limits private land sales that were often seen as exploiting Native people. And also, this is key when we look at the American Revolution, limiting European settlement, that the land west of the Appalachians was to be Indian territory. And that was extremely controversial in the 13 colonies, which had a much higher population and, you know, more arable land than the regions that are now Canada. And there was a lot of pressure. There was a lot of pressure for expansion. So the fact that this document had been drawn up between the Crown and the First Nations that didn't appear to take into account the expanding population of the 13 colonies, that made this document extremely unpopular in what is now the United States, even as it was seen as bringing stability to what is now Canada. The Royal Proclamation celebrated its 250th anniversary a couple of years ago, and it's enshrined in the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms that nothing in the Charter will abrogate the rights provided by the Royal Proclamation of 1763. So this is still very much a living document in Canada. Regarding the relationship with Magna Carta, Magna Carta had set a framework in terms of there being accords between the king and various groups of inhabitants of the monarch's kingdom. And so we see Magna Carta serving as a framework for both the Royal Proclamation and other accords with First Peoples around the world. In New Zealand, for instance, the Treaty of Waitangi that gave birth to the modern state of New Zealand, it was an agreement between the Crown and the Maori people there. So in Canada and New Zealand and other nations as well, there's a sense of the Crown having this very special relationship with the First Peoples. Of course, as you mentioned, this is not how this was perceived in the 13 colonies, and the Royal Proclamation was seen as an impediment to growth rather than providing a fair deal to the native allies of the British.
You mentioned that the proclamation line serves as a divergent point between United States and Canadian history. Let's explore that just a bit. First, would you tell us about the role Magna Carta played in the American Revolution and the founding of the United States?
Well, when we think about Magna Carta's role in the American Revolution, it's important to emphasize that often it was Cook's commentaries on Magna Carta rather than the document itself that was playing a very key role in the American Revolution that Thomas Jefferson, for instance, wrote to James Madison, and he was praising not Magna Carta itself, but Cook's work on Magna Carta, stating a sounder Whig never wrote, nor a profounder learning in the orthodox doctrines of the British Constitution, or in what were called English liberties. And of John Leland, a Baptist minister, wrote in 1794, "There's no constitution in Britain, although they consider the 72 articles of the Magna Carta the basis of their government, yet from that basis they've never formed a constitution to describe the limits of each department of government, so precedents and parliamentary acts are all the constitution they have." So the idea that Magna Carta was this foundation document that guaranteed equality before the law and liberties, including, as Cook interpreted, freedom from arbitrary taxation, inspired many of the key figures in the American Revolution. Magna Carta was also seen as a way of bringing together the very diverse settlers who settled in what is now the United States. William Penn, for instance, had Magna Carta printed, feeling as though settlers who came from regions that were not part of the English-speaking world should know their rights under Magna Carta so that they could integrate into the political and legal traditions of the 13 colonies. So Magna Carta assumed this totemic status in the United States that continues to the present day, because the key figures in the American Revolution viewed the document as being the foundation of all English liberties and political and legal rights, in the same manner as Sir Edward Cook had interpreted Magna Carta in 17th century England.
How has Magna Carta influenced Canada and its government? Also, would you provide us with a brief overview of the structure of the Canadian government?
Well, the system of government in Canada is different from that of the United States in that Canada is a constitutional monarchy with the Queen as head of state, as she is in 16 Commonwealth realms around the world, such as Australia, New Zealand, Jamaica, Papua New Guinea, the Solomon Islands. So we share a head of state with these other Commonwealth realms, but it's a distinct Canadian crown, the Queen in her role as Queen of the United Kingdom. That's separate from her role as Queen of Canada. The Prime Minister is head of government over a parliamentary system, and Canada achieved Confederation in 1867. So this is later than the American Revolution, and Magna Carta had reached a different stage in its development. Over the course of the 19th century, a number of parliamentary acts repealed some of the specific clauses of Magna Carta. There are still clauses that remain on the statute books in the United Kingdom. For instance, freedom for the church, freedom for the city of London, and the justice will not be denied or delayed, one of the key clauses that had remained constant throughout the 13th century versions of Magna Carta. But the fact that Canada achieved its independence and inherited the British constitutional and legal and political traditions in the 19th century rather than earlier meant that Magna Carta came to assume a different role. In Canada, Magna Carta came to be seen as a symbolic document to a greater degree that guaranteed rights and freedoms rather than legislation that should be taken literally. Magna Carta has been cited in Canadian court cases, but there's a sense that it's amenable to parliamentary legislation, whereas in the United States, for example, there are key clauses of Magna Carta and ideas from Magna Carta that went straight into the Bill of Rights in the Constitution. So Magna Carta was treated more literally in the American context than in the Canadian context, in which Magna Carta was but one aspect of this larger British constitutional tradition. A key aspect of Magna Carta's legacy for Canada is the development of the constitutional monarchy. As I mentioned before, King John is the first monarch to accept limits on his power imposed by his subjects, and that process continues with some exceptions. The Tudor period, as I mentioned before, as an example, monarchs have more power, but there's this general progression of monarchs having their powers limited more and more. Charles I, who had been limited by the Petition of Right, he decided to dismiss Parliament from 1629 to 1640, and ultimately Charles I lost his kingdom and his head during the English Civil Wars of the 1640s. And although the monarchy was restored in England in 1660, Charles I's descendants knew that they could not attempt to govern as Charles I had done, and had to make accords with their subjects. In 1689, following the Glorious Revolution of 1688, Charles I's grandchildren, William of Orange, who became William III, and Mary II, were invited to become joint King and Queen of England on the condition that they accepted a Bill of Rights that would limit their power and the power of their successors. So in the Canadian context, we see not only the English common law system, which had such a profound impact on the whole English-speaking world, but Magna Carta being at the beginning of this process that led to the development of a constitutional monarchy with the monarch as head of state and the prime minister as head of government, that continues to be the system of government in Canada.
We have gone from the 13th century to the 18th century. Let's bring it home, Carolyn. What would you say the legacy of Magna Carta is today? Do you think that the Great Charter and its ideas are still relevant in our 21st century?
Yes, I think Magna Carta and its ideas remain relevant because this is a living document that has been interpreted and reinterpreted over the centuries. And in the 20th century context, it informed the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And so the committee chaired by American First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt that brought together this declaration made use of Magna Carta and other legal documents from around the world. And it took some of the ideas of Magna Carta that perhaps had only been seen in the context of the English-speaking world into a wider, more global context. And so we see 800 years after Magna Carta that its promises of freedom from arbitrary rule and equality before the law continue to resonate in a variety of political and social contexts.
Let's move into the time warp. This is a fun segment of the show where we ask you a hypothetical history question about what might have happened if something had occurred differently or if someone had acted differently.
The time warp. Historians can't predict the future, but they can speculate about what might have been.
Carolyn, in your opinion, what might have happened if Sir Edward Coke had not revived memory of Magna Carta? How would the histories of England, the United States, and Canada be different today?
Well, it's difficult to argue a counterfactual, particularly as Coke was not the only legal scholar in the early 17th century writing about Magna Carta. There were other lawyers at the time who were writing about this, but Coke's very significant in that he takes the ideas of Magna Carta into the political realm in terms of limiting Charles I's powers and contributing to the development of the 13 colonies. So I think that without Coke's commentaries on Magna Carta, that the various political movements over time, whether it was the English Civil Wars or the American Revolution, would have been deprived of a great deal of historical legitimacy, that both those who opposed Charles I during the English Civil Wars and those who opposed George III during the American Revolution emphasized that they were defending centuries-old rights. And without Coke's commentaries on Magna Carta, that historical legitimacy might have been missing from their arguments.
Canada and the United States. Two different nations, but we share Magna Carta. And of course, in the United States, we're spoiled because we have our own copy of Magna Carta, which the National Archives keeps on display in the National Archives Museum in Washington, D.C. However, in 2015, Canadians and anyone visiting Canada can see a copy of Magna Carta, which is touring the nation. Carolyn, would you tell us which copy of Magna Carta is touring Canada and where and when we can view it?
The version of Magna Carta that's currently touring Canada is from Durham Cathedral's collection, and it was issued during the reign of John's grandson, Edward I. His barons were adamant that they would not support his Scottish campaign, and yet, unless he reissued Magna Carta. So the Magna Carta of 1300 is touring Canada. It's currently in Ottawa at the Museum of History, and then it will be traveling to Winnipeg and the later in the summer to the Human Rights Museum, and then to Fort York here in Toronto in the fall, and then to Edmonton. So the touring Magna Carta will be visiting four Canadian provinces over the course of the tour.
Is there a website where we can go and learn more about Magna Carta's Canadian tour?
Yes, MagnaCartaCanada.ca has the full schedule of the Canadian Magna Carta tour.
Fantastic. Before we conclude, would you tell us about your second forthcoming book, Queenship and Revolution in Early Modern Europe, Henrietta Maria and Marie Antoinette?
Yes, my second book is going to be based on my PhD dissertation that looked at the role of the Queen during the English Civil Wars and the French Revolution. Now, I discussed these two events in my Magna Carta book, as they were both informed by Magna Carta in various ways. But in my second book, I'm going to look at how the Queen, Henrietta Maria, in the case of the English Civil Wars, and Marie Antoinette, in the case of the French Revolution, was perceived as a wife, mother, and head of royal household, and how often opposition to the king was expressed by delegitimizing the role of the queen, her being seen as a wicked advisor. And I also look at how these various queens tried to fight back against their poor reputations, that they weren't simply, you know, passive figures who had these bad reputations projected onto them. They both tried with limited success to project their own ideas of being the good wife and the good mother and the good royal consort, contributing to the ideological debates of their era. So the second book will look at Queen Henrietta Maria and Queen Marie Antoinette as wives, mothers, and heads of royal households, and the role of their reputations during the English Civil Wars and the French Revolution.
When will that be available?
That'll be available November 5th of this year.
Well, congratulations on your second forthcoming book launch.
Oh, thank you. It's been a busy year.
Where is the best place for us to look for more information about you, your work, and how to get in contact with you?
Well, my website, royalhistorian.com, contains links to my various articles and book chapters and updates about my book projects. I'm also on Twitter at Royal Historian and on Facebook as Carolyn Harris Author, so I'm all over the internet and always glad to receive questions from readers.
We'll have links to Carolyn's various websites and social media handles on the show notes page for this episode, along with links to Magna Carta Canada and the U.S. National Archives Museum, so you can find more information about how you can see Magna Carta in person. Carolyn, thank you so much for helping us celebrate Magna Carta's 800th birthday by helping us discover more about how it influenced early American history.
Thank you.
I can't believe we just did that. We just covered 800 years of history in about 45 minutes. This seems like a big accomplishment, so go ahead and give yourself a pat on the back. Now, it might seem odd that a podcast about early American history just spent about a half an hour investigating the English Middle Ages. But as Carolyn revealed, Magna Carta was a really important document here in North America. Magna Carta helped inspire and influence the way that the founding fathers framed and shaped the governments in both Canada and the United States. I also think our 800-year odyssey was an important one to make, because on this podcast, we spend a lot of time talking about how the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries have impacted and shaped our present-day 21st century. Well, guess what? The Middle Ages helped impact and shape the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries we discovered. So in a very long 800-year kind of way, the Middle Ages has shaped our present-day world. And I think it's important that we see that continuity here in history. You can find more information about Carolyn, her book, Magna Carta and Its Gifts to Canada, and everything we talked about today on the show notes page for this episode. BenFranklinsWorld.com/038. Have you signed up for our Ben Franklin's World listener meetup yet? It's going to take place on August 15th here in Boston, and it's going to be a tour of the city talking about the revolution and specifically the Stamp Act. We're going to commemorate the 250th anniversary of the Stamp Act riots here in Boston with a special tour. a tour that I wrote. So I hope you're going to come along because I'm really excited to show you my city. You can find more information about the tour and you can sign up by going to benfranklinsworld.com/meetup. Now, I know I have way more people downloading this podcast than are in Poor Richard's Club, and it's fine if you don't want to join. But if you've been meaning to join Poor Richard's Club so you can hang out with me and all our other friends that love history, well, you could text BFWorld to 33444 and sign up for the Franklin Gazette right on your cell phone. That's right, you can do that. 33444, text BFWorld. And you'll have the opportunity there to get access to Poor Richard's Club, our social community on Facebook, and you'll also get the Franklin Gazette, which will put every week's show notes right in your inbox, so you won't even have to visit all those URLs that I give you. Finally, have you seen Magna Carta in person? I had the opportunity to see it at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston last year in 2014, and it was a pretty impressive sight. The document wasn't nearly as big as I thought it would be, but it was still impressive. If you've seen Magna Carta, I'd love to know what your experience has been. Why don't you post a comment in Poor Richard's Club on the show notes page for this episode? You can send the comment to me via email, liz@benfranklinsworld.com, or if you can fit it in 140 characters, go ahead and tweet it to me, @LizCovart.
And remember, never leave till tomorrow that which you can do today.